is ambiguous, morally so, for it increases the possibility of man to transcend himself in favor of the community, but it also increases the possibility of this man or that community to impress himself upon the rest. It requires a good deal of intelligence to be imperialistic in your vision and in your technique. These are the obvious facts about history, that freedom is ambiguous. There's a second miscalculation in this that comes closer to our religious problem. We had also assumed that the conquest of nature was identical with the conquest of self. Cannot, to the modern man, the same science by which we have altered the face of nature make it possible for us to alter the habits of men? This is, I am convinced, one of the most serious miscalculations in modern culture. We think of the human mind as some kind of a transcendent, pure human mind that monkeys with the stuff of human nature, which is nothing but animal impulse. Now, the real fact is, of course, that self-conquest is a much more complicated proposition because we are ourselves in this mind, and we are ourselves in this stuff of nature that has to be mastered. One of the things that really worries me about a good deal of modern theory about how we're going to get rid of war and so forth is that it's always manipulative. Some wise person is going to manipulate human nature so that it would be very nice. Here's a psychologist who's written a book called Walden Number 2 that I'd like to commend to you, not because it's a good book, because it's symbolic. Walden Number 2. Now, this book suggests, and he doesn't deny, that it's a kind of a Hitler who's running this ideal utopian community. It's a concept of a psychologist's vision of a utopia. And it's a kind of a Hitler who's running this, and he's challenged whether he isn't very manipulative, and he says, yes, but I do it for their good. Very dangerous concept. And he creates a society in which children are taught from the earliest years to be so adjusted to each other that there's no jealousy or any kind of egoistic friction in this community. It's an idyllic community. There's several difficulties with it. It has to be limited to 600 people. Because, he says, if you take the larger community, you won't be able to manage all of the ambitions that come out of it. This is, in other words, a chicken yard utopia. There is no evil there, but there's no nobility there either. These manipulative tendencies, Mr. Brock Chisholm, and now I'd like to come back to Mr. Brock Chisholm. Mr. Brock Chisholm, who's the head of the World Health Organization, recently suggested that the aggressiveness of nation is merely the accumulation of the aggressiveness of individuals, which is, I think, a very deep mistake. The aggressiveness of nations is the accumulation of the aggressiveness of individuals, and the aggressiveness of individuals comes out of their insecurity. Let us establish all over the world, says he, mother's clinics, which will give the children such uncritical love that they will be absolutely secure, and they will blossom into world citizens. At the anniversary of the MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, a year ago, they had long faculty discussions on all the problems of the universe, and Mr. Winston Churchill spoke in the evening after one of these discussions. And he made a significant remark about these manipulative efforts to redeem the world. He said, the Dean of the Humanities assured us this morning that psychological techniques were being elaborated, which would make the day possible when we would control the very thoughts in the minds of men. And Mr. Churchill said in his robust praise, I will be well content to be dead in that day. They mean it for good, but they will destroy the last citadel of human dignity. The problem of self-conquest, of man not making himself the center of the universe, either individually or collectively, is, of course, endlessly helped by every psychological and sociological science, but it's never the same as the problem of the mastery of nature. I think it's a very bad thing, by the way, that we so frequently put man on the level of nature and not recognize, for instance, The man is a historical creature to begin with, and that you can't tell the difference between a German and an Englishman merely by the possible difference in the way that German mothers taught their children toilet habits, as another gentleman suggests. But the difference between the German and the English one are historical differences coming out of vast and intricate historical developments of community. Where the English have been particularly fortunate and particularly wise is against the pathos of German collective life. These are some of the mistakes that we made in miscalculating the proposition, but I mustn't go any further into the mistakes because quite obviously we have miscalculated the problem of human development. For I think it's quite obvious that it is like this, that history solves many problems as it goes along. And at each point, we have to solve a new problem, including the problem of community on this level of technique. Only it does not solve the ultimate problem of human existence. You can see this very easily. We could have known it if we had looked at our own life. Here we are, for instance, as children. This is like the childhood of the race. We are weak. From the standpoint of the child, the one thing is to have the strength of adolescence. Adolescence is the answer to the problem of childhood. But adolescence is not the answer to the problem of adolescence. Adolescence, with its Sturm und Drang and all its problems, sexual and otherwise. Male and female created he them. These two sexes must have come together in an organic unity. Marriage is the solution to the problem of adolescence. But marriage is quite obviously not the answer to the problem of marriage. We move into maturity, and there are all kinds of strengths and weaknesses in maturity. And perhaps some of us look forward to the senility when the fevers of life have been dampened. Senility is the answer to the problem of the stresses of maturity, but quite obviously there are frustrations in senility for which senility is not the answer. This is a very simple proposition that we should have seen all the time as we were moving along. It is a good thing, as St. Augustine said, that men should become men. It is a good thing that a child should grow up into manhood and that the whole of our civilization should grow up into these vast civilizations. This is good per se, but it does not solve the problem of human existence. Every one of the problems, as a matter of fact, is accentuated. Which brings me to the point, the concluding point of what I think belongs to what we call our spiritual reorientation. I speak frankly as a Christian who believes that the story of progress has been made the substitute for a profounder understanding of the infinite tragedy and the sublime meaning of human existence. This is too simple an answer. If we want to survive spiritually in a day like this, I think we will have to reclaim some of the great inheritances of faith which we have dropped out. Let me mention just a few. First of all, we cannot expect security in human existence. There must be some way, some faith that gives us a sense of an ultimate security beyond all the caprices of nature and history. It is a good thing to get as much security against the caprice of nature as we can, and our modern technical society has given it. But don't you think it's a very ironic thing that a culture which dismisses the fact of death, which contains within it this whole contrast between man's greatness and man's weakness, he dies, he brings his years to an end like a tale he's told. So a culture which dismisses the fact of death because it is conquering disease faces the same death in a new social dimension. We are no longer afraid of death in nature, but we're afraid of killing each other. This is a terrible thing. A social dimension has been added. And I rather imagine that some of the hysteria in which we stand is not merely the hysteria of facing atomic destruction, but of facing destruction at all when we imagine that we were safe. Man isn't safe. Man is never safe. In this ultimate sense, there will never be security for man. He's a very curious kind of creature who does elaborate things that belong to the eternal, and yet he does bring his years to an end like a tailor. It's always a part of life. And there must be, in the wisdom of life, the wisdom of faith, which can be nonchalant about this. I mustn't speak unctuously of
about this. None of us all are altogether nonchalant, but none of us can really live serenely until we have established something like the nonchalance of St. Paul, which can say whether we live, we are the Lord's. Whether we die, we are the Lord's. Whether we live, therefore, or die, we are the Lord's. Secondly, we cannot be healthy if we expect tomorrow to be the fulfillment of today. Very simply. This is what has come out of a historical culture. Things are wrong today, but they will be all right tomorrow. Now, this is a part of life. We are historical creatures, and part of the meaning of our existence lies in this relationship to tomorrow. Every parent is justified of his children. We look forward to how these children grow up. We look toward tomorrow, rightly so, yet not absolutely so, for every parent has aspects of his existence which are not in this historical stream at all, which stand surely like this, vertically, as it were. We're not fulfilled in tomorrow. In the 18th century, when it stopped believing in God, they substituted posterity for God. Did you ever read some of these prayers? O posterity, judge us. O posterity, save us. Now, when we think that we're the posterity that they were praying to, this is very embarrassing. Posterity is quite obviously not a good surrogate for the ultimate meaning of existence, for we are as perplexed, if not more so, than the 18th century. The idea that any frustration, that any fragmentariness of life, that any ambiguity of our existence will be overcome in an unambiguous tomorrow has been one of the most terrible sources of confusion in our life. I remember a sensitive young veteran coming out of the Pacific in the last war back to his college to do graduate work. And I saw a fire of fanaticism in his eye. He had lost two brothers and three very close Yale classmates. These tragedies had, of course, deeply affected him. And he had one idea. We must make history good enough to justify these sacrifices. So he had all kinds of desperate schemes. And then he saw this awful, yawning new tragedy, a conflict between ourselves and the Russians. And he saw that history wasn't good enough today to justify these sacrifices of yesterday. And it drove him into a hysterical mood. And I saw in that, in him, the symbol of the spiritual frustration of our day. Now, we might, of course, be better off than we are if things had been done this way or that way, but nevertheless, our today would not have been good enough to justify the sacrifices of yesterday. There must be some vertical dimension in our deeds, and not purely the horizontal one. We will have to do a lot of things for which we can find no absolutely sure hope tomorrow. Even today, we're involved in a world situation where our leaders say to us, rightly, I think, there are no safe investments anymore. There are only calculated risks. Well, our American nation has to discipline itself for decades without being able to guarantee that we will come out into a new tomorrow. We may come out in catastrophe, which means that we will have to stand the man today and learn what it means. Be not anxious for tomorrow. Sufficient is the day of the evil thereof. That also means to learn some eternal quality in the present moment, which we have neglected. Life is fragmentary. Life is always fragmentary. It will continue to be so. Not only insecure, but fragmentary. And tomorrow does not make it less so. There is an ultimate problem here which is not solved by the course of history. Which brings me to the final point. The meaning of our existence. Which is always the final question. Does life make sense? It has to be answered less simply. Life does not simply make sense. There are no simple rational correlations in either nature or history which make sense out of it. Aristotle and Plato had a simple scheme, simply of recurrence. But the whole of history was dropped out. It made no sense. The only way that life made sense was that you were emancipated from history.